You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2016 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Good evening and welcome on this beautiful summer night to the 20th anniversary celebration of the Penn Emerging Voices. And welcome to Aloud. Give yourself a hand. I was actually here 20 years ago for that other reading that was here, and so it's such a very special honor to welcome you all back to this very special culminating event of the Penn Emerging Voices Fellowship year. I'm Louise Steinman, the curator of the Aloud series, and I'm just delighted to welcome you here. I want to thank the wonderful staff of Penn, Amanda and Libby and Michelle, of course, for working with us, making this happen. You'll get to mingle and mix with them and the fellows afterwards. It is such a deep honor to present the Penn Emerging Voices. I'm a longtime Penn member myself, and I can't say how strongly I feel about Penn and its role in the community, the way it supports writers and supports students in the school, learning to love poetry and literature and encouraging their talents. So with no more further ado, I'm going to welcome Michelle Franke, who's the executive director, and hope you'll all join us afterwards for the reception. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. So I'm Michelle Franke, the executive director of Penn Center USA. Welcome to the final reading and 20th anniversary celebration with the 2016 Emerging Voices Fellows. The Emerging Voices Fellowship is a literary mentorship that aims to provide new writers who are isolated from the literary establishment with the tools, skills, and knowledge they need to launch a professional writing career. We're proud to say that, according to the NEA, it is the only fellowship of its kind in the United States. It's a special honor for us to be presenting this event in this room tonight, not only because Aloud is a cornerstone of the Los Angeles literary community, but because the Emerging Voices Fellowship actually grew out of Writing the Immigrant Experience, a Penn Center USA forum held here at the Central Library in March 1994. Following the forum, it was evident that many area writers felt isolated from the literary establishment. As a response, in fall 1996, Penn Center USA initiated the Emerging Voices Fellowship, a mentorship program designed to launch the careers of writers from underrepresented communities who demonstrated great potential. Much has changed since 1996 in that each Emerging Voices Fellowship now includes UCLA Extension Writers Program workshops, author evenings, master classes, a public speaking tutorial, volunteer projects, a $1,000 stipend, and public readings. Though the resources have multiplied over time, mentorship remains the backbone of the Emerging Voices Fellowship. Hoping to give you a sense of that invaluable relationship, tonight's program will feature the 2016 Emerging Voices mentors introducing their mentees' readings. Natalie, Marnie, Chelsea, Wendy, and Jen, congratulations from me to you. Providing opportunities for voices to be heard, which is so essential these days, is a responsibility that we do not take lightly. Tonight, you five join the 131 writers who have already completed the Emerging Voices Fellowship. The supportive community of artists and friends has published over 40 books and earned hundreds of awards, publications, and honors. We have no doubt the five of you will be adding to this list soon enough. Many people make the Emerging Voices Fellowship possible, and we thank them in your program. Not mentioned there, but deserving of praise, Libby Flores, program manager, and Amanda Fletcher, program coordinator. If the mentors are the backbone of the Emerging Voices Fellowship, you too are certainly the heart. Finally, if you're thinking that the Emerging Voices Fellowship is the next step in your writing career, I encourage you to apply. I like this Henry Ford quote, "You can't build a reputation on what you are going to do." So pick up an apply card tonight and know that we're already looking forward to reading your work. Now I'd like to welcome author Mike Padilla to the stage, who will begin tonight's reading. Enjoy.
These are 400 words introducing the Queen of Second Person. When you meet the writer you have been asked to mentor, you are relieved that the disappointment in her face is not too severe. Her smile, her hug, her enthusiasm reassure you, this mentoring thing is going to be okay. A few days later, she emails to ask if you would look at a short story she has written and tell her whether you think it is, quote, a piece of garbage, unquote. Oh, and by the way, she adds, the story is in second person. Second person. Of all the persons, second person might be your least favorite person. You have never cared for her intrusiveness, her awkward insistence, or emotional closeness. Nevertheless, you print out the pages, turn off Orange is the New Black, settle into your favorite spot on the red reading couch, and dive in. The first sentence of her story, in which a sister rips her brother to shreds for making fun of a girl who's just killed herself, is like a punch in the face you didn't know you wanted. The story shoves you forward on greased wheels of pain, memory, and regret. As you approach the final paragraph, you feel it gathering behind your eyes, beginning to blur your vision, tears. You are relieved, thrilled, this woman can write. Also, you are screwed, because what do you have to offer a writer who already knows how to bring you to tears in less than 5 pages? In the vague hope that your own writing life has something to offer her, you recommend John Gardner's book about writing fiction. You say things like, dialogue isn't what people say to each other, it's what they do to each other. But you discover that your favorite part of this whole mentoring thing, what you are cut out for, if nothing else, is to cheer. You cheer from the stands when she reads, across Facebook when she publishes her first, second, and third stories, and with brain hemorrhaging enthusiasm when she gets into the MFA program at Alabama. And you recall, in some cases, for the first time in many, many years, the cheerleaders from your own life, the ones who first called you writer, without irony, without air quotes. Never mind that you also find yourself stealing from her, the turn of phrase she does not know you have lifted from her, her power pose, her use of the second person. At a final writing celebration in a downtown library in a shining metropolis, someone calls out your name. On your way to the stage, your heart trips a few times, out of nervousness for her, but also excitement for the audience who will now get to hear what feels like a delicious secret you have been keeping to yourself. You take the steps, you place your notes on the podium, you adjust the mic, and with a peculiar melancholy that comes when one lovely thing ends in order to make room for the next, you say, I'm proud, happy, and honored to introduce you to a wonderful writer, an even more wonderful human being, and my friend, Natalie Lima.
And oh man, if I didn't have so much anxiety right now, I'd cry. First, I want to thank Penn for this amazing experience and for making me feel like my story should be told. It's an experience I'll never forget the rest of my life. So thank you so much. Mike, thank you so much for being so generous with me and for reading whatever I send you hot off the press late at night, a few hours before reading. So thank you for that. And for pushing me to be the best writer I can be. And I'm so grateful to Penn for putting us together. So thanks so much, Mike. Okay, so I'm going to be reading. Let me chill. Let me power pose. I'm going to be reading first from a couple scenes from a short story about a woman who's a history teacher in high school, and she realizes that she has an alcohol problem, so she goes to a meeting. She makes a new friend. So I read a couple scenes from that, and then I'm going to read a very short story. So this is called Principles Before Personalities. That night, I decided to check out one of these meetings I'd heard about from a directory I found online. I picked one in Beverly Hills to avoid running into anyone I knew on the East Side, though I'd secretly hoped for a surprise celebrity sighting, someone like Russell Brand, or better yet, Bradley Cooper, sharing tales of his drunken and hopeless pre-fame days. On the drive over, I imagined what the scenario with Bradley would look like. Him sitting with his head bowed in shame, his hair a greasy mess, his blue eyes glazed over with tears. When I woke up in the presidential suite at the Bellagio next to a naked hooker named Scar, he'd confessed, the tears gushing out of his eyes now. I knew that it was finally time to get some help. Then he'd weep and I'd give him a hug and tell him that I was proud of his vulnerability. It was very sweet the way I pictured it. We'd eventually fall in love and have cute mixed babies. Here's a scene from later in the meeting when it's time for sharing. A timer went off when it came time to share in the meeting, and a bunch of the women vigorously raised their hands. The leader lady took turns pointing and calling on each of them, you, you, then you. First, a lawyer shared about her Adderall addiction while in law school at Berkeley. Then, an old widow almost hyperventilated talking about the death of her 17-year-old deaf cat. Patches could never hear my footsteps coming, but somehow he always knew when I was there, she said, sobbing. Finally, a redhead with a cute pixie cut, maybe 30 or so, about my age, began reading us a text message exchange she'd had with her married coworker just before the meeting started. Baby, I'm dying to taste you. Everyone was still, and my ears instantly perked up. So am I, Tony, but I know your wife. You know I can't do this to her. I leaned in. No, Janine, this is different. You know we don't even sleep in the same room anymore. That was the end of the exchange before Janine's phone died. We were left at a cliffhanger, like something straight out of an episode of General Hospital. A silence fell on the room. Everyone looked down at their feet and then not so discreetly at each other, then more silence. Can I share? I asked, raising my hand up high. The leader lady eagerly nodded, seemingly grateful that someone was breaking the silence. Luce, alcoholic, I think. Hi, Luce, said all the women in a chorus. Janine, girl, I know I don't know you, but your life is a giant ass mess. I looked right at her as I said this because I wasn't lying to her, and because it seemed like every woman I knew had been involved in something this reckless before. Or maybe I only attracted friends who'd had dysfunctional childhoods like mine, who knows. You need to dump that fool ASAP, I continued. He's manipulating you, can't you see? How dense are you? The leader lady interrupted. I'm sorry, Luce, right? I know you're new here, but there's no cross-talking in this meeting. What the fuck is cross-talking? Everyone shifted in their seats, turning away from me as if I was the crazy one now. So that's all the time we have for sharing, ladies. I looked over at Janine. She didn't say anything back to me. She just looked at me like I'd said something she'd never heard before, like I just made her aware that the earth was indeed round and not flat. So that's the end of that. I haven't told the pen people this, but I wrote a story last week. I was at a writing workshop for people of color called Vona, and I was asked to write an essay about identity, which turned into a very short story instead evolved this past week. So this is called You'll Finally See Snow. One, you are sitting on the tattered couch that also doubles as your bed when your mommy hands you the giant envelope marked, this is the big one. You're 17, and here is the college acceptance letter you've been waiting for, the one from your dream school in Chicago, You'll Finally See Snow. The letter includes flattering phrases like, you were one of thousands of applicants, and you're the creme de la creme, and we're giving generous scholarships to diverse candidates like you. Your mommy hugs you hard in her grease-stained uniform, and you scream together, jumping in circles for almost an hour. Two. The next day, you sign all the paperwork in your best cursive and place it carefully in an envelope like it's your grandma's birthday card. After you toss it into the mailbox, you think, this is what I've been waiting for my whole damn life. Over the summer, you buy some winter clothes and gather all the books you own. which isn't much, but each item is priceless to you, and you thoughtfully pack them into the only suitcase you own, one by one. At the airport, your mommy sobs uncontrollably, telenovela style, but you don't cry at all. You don't cry because you've earned this, because you're poor and you're Latin and your dad left, and yet you still killed it on the SAT. You are clearly destined for greatness. You don't cry because you're dying to leave your barrio, dying to leave the couch you sleep on, because this fancy school is where you were always meant to be. Three. As soon as you move into your dorm, you fit right in. Conversation is way easier than you expect. You can talk about European literature and art history, can name drop every white virtuoso who ever picked up a quill or a paintbrush. You can quote Chaucer and Dante, can easily recount the life stories, every tiny detail about Gauguin, Van Gogh, Cezanne, Thoreau, and Pissarro. Did you know Gauguin lived with Van Gogh in a tiny house in the south of France? This will be your favorite opener. After you ace your second poli-sci midterm in November, you strut back to your dorm in your new North Face jacket and Uggs, purchased with $300 your mom gave you after pawning her earrings. She wanted you to be ready for the cold. When you arrive at your floor, the halls are quiet, and you make your way to the bathroom on the other side of the hall. Before you reach it, you hear a group of people chatting in someone's room. Sarah from Connecticut says, "You know what's really surprising? Camilla from Miami is super smart. I didn't expect that at all, right? I think she's better read than I am," and a few yas follow. You stop, forget the bathroom, and head back to your room. You rather hold it all in. You've always been so good at holding everything in. You close the door quietly behind you and plop onto your little bed. The heat is all consuming now, so you unzip your North Face and throw it across the room. It accidentally lands on your roommate's desk, but you can't seem to move right now. For a moment, you don't think about anything. You sit still, you just breathe. Eventually, you turn and look out the window. The sky is gray, almost white. It's finally starting to snow. Thank you.
It is my pleasure to be here for Marnie, good friend, and I'm actually not Marnie's mentor. I'm here for Claire Bidwell-Smith. I'm Krista Paravani, and I really wish I had been Marnie's mentor, actually. We had the pleasure of sharing a meal this week, and I feel like after talking with her about her work and reading her work, I was so touched by how thoughtful her work is, how lyrical her work is, and how humane her work is, which is so important in creative nonfiction. So I think before I read what Claire had prepared, I just wanted to say that. Marnie, I wish I'd been your mentor. This is from Claire. Over the last 6 months, I have come to know Marnie as an extraordinarily gifted writer, and it has been my enormous pleasure to work with her. Through the Emerging Voices program, I have seen her transform into a truer version of her writing self, and I couldn't be more proud of all of the work she has done. Marnie is one of those writers who just knows how to write from the very core of her being. She sees the world around her with a keen eye and an emotional intelligence that translates into magic on the page. Marnie gives herself permission to bend language to suit her unique voice. She knows how to tap into an emotion. She knows how to reveal a character and deepen a story by beginning or ending it in just the right place. Her work in progress, her memoir, Birthmarks, follows the story of her childhood as an adopted daughter being raised in a turbulent and abusive family in an affluent suburb. And Marnie probes the dynamics and themes in her story with a thoughtfulness that allows the reader to fully enter her world, a rare thing. Marnie is an intimidating writer to her mentor, precisely because of her talent. Yet, Marnie still needs what all of us need in our writing lives: guidance, support, community, opportunity, everything that the Penn Emerging Voices Fellowship seeks to provide. I am so grateful for the opportunity to have been part of this amazing program, and I'm looking forward to a long future of working with Marnie. I can't wait to see her work in print, and for all of you to have a chance to be moved by her talented voice. Thank you on Claire's behalf, and I welcome Marnie, good friend.
Quite the dramatic entrance. Thank you, Krista. Thank you to my mentor, Claire. How did I ever get so lucky to have you? Thank you for pushing me when I needed to move forward and holding me when I needed to be still. I love you dearly. Thank you to everyone at Penn, Amanda, Libby, Michelle, for being our compass. This piece, Elaine, is from my first memoir, Birthmarks, and is dedicated to my dad who brought me safely to shore. I miss you. Sometimes my mother is another woman named Elaine. She has white blonde hair like a movie star and creepy spider eyelashes. I organize my Barbie shoes in their see-through containers below the sink where the drain twists itself into the hole in the wall. Elaine says things like, "Wouldn't you like to see what's underneath these clothes?" She's talking again to the mirror on the living room wall, as if she can talk back. Why is it called a living room when no one ever lives there except my mom and her reflection? It's just to admire, like me. Her words stick to my brain like crazy glue. I count the number of moms I have on my left hand. On my thumb, my real mom or my birth mom. My index finger is my adoptive mother, Marilyn, who is also Elaine, my middle finger. The ring finger is my stepmother, Angie. I have four moms. I wonder when I'll get a pinky finger mother and if she'll like me. My index finger mother flips her head upside down, tucking her real fire ant hair underneath the solid gold wig. When the blood rushes back to her head, blonde and upright, she is Elaine. "Let's go," she announces. I tug on the ribbon of my Lance nightgown with the ruffles at the wrists and ankles and stare at my bare feet. "No one is going to see you," she breathes in my face. I am shoved into the back seat of our Cadillac. I sit on all of my counting fingers because she's caught my pinky, the one I'm saving for another mother in the door once before, and I had to wear a silver straightener called a splint for my finger sandwich. Elaine talks to herself like a character on my mother's soap operas she watches lying naked on our bunny brown couch. I, too, watch Champagne Toasts and Identical Twins and something called Amnesia, quiet like a mouse on the carpet behind her head. I'm supposed to be entertaining myself in the playroom, but I can't take my eyes off the women in glitter dresses and the men with their cornflower blue eyes. "Of course I would like to come in, just for a little nightcap," she rehearses. I wonder why she would go into some man's house to put on a nightcap after spending so much time pinning a wig to the top of her head. We drive for miles, stretches of black with pinhole stars that remind me of the silver studs I turn clockwise every night, like the woman at MediMart told me to before she shot my earlobes with a needle gun. Elaine creeps into a parking lot marked with white lines for residents and yellow for visitors. We are neither. We are unannounced and uninvited. She backs into a spot under a weeping willow tree. The branches droop over the car like a sad blanket. "I'm not spying on you, obviously," she says to no one. Nothing is obvious to me except that I probably should be sleeping in my bed, or at least wearing my puffy coat with the red and yellow stripes that meet each other at the front and zip together like they're saying, "Nice to meet you." She never looks my way in the rearview mirror while she puckers her lips and rolls out a tube of lipstick. Elaine, not Marilyn, wears number 62 Carlo Chanel to match her wig. I have blonde hair too, but she says it's the color of dirty dishwater, no matter how much I wash it. For a moment, I am remembered. She opens her mouth as I wait for her to reveal the next clue, pretending that we are on an adventure together. "I'm visiting Tommy David," she says, pointing to the darkness outside. "Do not get out of this car." Before I can say a word, the door slams shut as she locks the car from the outside. If I were a magician, I could find a way to escape through the crack in the window. The clock has stopped dead. Maybe I'll be frozen in time. I wait and watch the stillness and silence. I wait. The dark is so deep I can see to the other side. With a torch lamp to light the way, I fly into the night sky on a fluffy unicorn with satin fur. Her horn is dipped in gold and smells like a strawberry starburst. The sun warms my feet and hugs my shoulders. I slide off her wing at Campo Beach and make a castle out of purple sand with a drawbridge to protect myself from intruders. I call my birth mom on a seashell, and she appears with watercolor paint and brushes. Together we draw giant rainbows with cotton ball clouds, a dog smiling, and me holding hands with this woman who looks just like me, except a little older. We have matching polka dot bikini tops and mermaid tails instead of legs. She tells me not to fear the dark because she is always with me. I try to touch her, but she turns into grains of sand that get swept into the ocean. I look at where she pressed her heart into my hand. There is a small freckle in between my thumb and index finger. It is a birthmark, a reminder that not all permanent scars are bad. It is my North Star. As the sun pushes up from the pavement and washes the parking lot at Tangerine Dream, my unicorn lays me in the back seat, rubs her mane against my face, and disappears. I see business people in suits with powder-dressed shirts underneath wool coats and scarves that swing in unison with their briefcases. They rush to their cars. Their breath makes dad cigar smokes in the air. I watch them walk with envy, the way their legs move so freely. What it must be like to be on the outside, today or any day. My moms return to the car and press the gas pedal like our visitor's spot is on fire. The blonde wig has fallen from her crown and covers an ear. Her bloodshot eyes are wild like an animal who's escaped from its cage. She looks wounded, but dangerous. I close my eyes and press down hard on my birthmark. The memory of belonging lights a path before me like an airport runway. Thank you.
Time speeds up and slows down in huge swaths called ticks and talkings. A group of ghosts form a museum club and have a run-in with the living at Madame Tussaud's. A woman's unborn child haunts her, but only through the metal curve of a spoon. These are just a few of the very weird worlds that come out of Chelsea Sutton's brain, and that I have had the privilege of diving into with her. Many writers can come up with high-concept stories, but they so often lack real, felt characters. Other writers are best at heartfelt, character-driven stories, but that lack a plot or a conceptual edge. Chelsea does both with grace and intelligence. She draws you in with characters who are thorough and complex and relatable within outlandish situations that are specific enough to feel familiar. She inhabits strange lands and makes them feel like home. She makes us see our messy selves in the absurd and the uncanny. Chelsea tackles huge themes like time and love through specifics of family dinners or grade school hallways. She writes in one story, "Across town, the elementary school is flooded with teenagers in ill-fitting clothes. Newly minted adults are roaming the halls of the high schools. It takes a great amount of time to sort out who belongs where. This is a usual problem, the problem of where one belongs." End quote. She challenges the notions of the body and how the body does or does not define who we are through amorphous characters. In one story, a ghost takes on the form of all the things she's loved. She writes, "I feel my non-body, my soul, shift and shape into my favorite novel, and then my childhood cat, and then the boy I loved when I was 19, and then my grandmother's hands shuffling playing cards." In each story, Chelsea seems to be suggesting this truth. All anyone wants is to belong, and to do so, we have to make sense of a nonsensical world, so we might as well do it together. Often, while I was reading her stories, I would think, dang, I wish I'd thought of that. Chelsea makes her own rules. She's smart, but she doesn't show off. Her brain works in the weirdest ways, and I admire her. She has heart, and she has craft, and she's going to blow you away. Thanks.
Hello, everybody. Hey. First of all, quick thank you to Penn and Amanda and Libby and Carmi, my amazing mentor and the best editor I've ever had in my life. And of course, to my fellows, which are, I think, the best gift I have gotten from this entire fellowship. And I hope I get to keep them forever and ever. I'm going to read a section, an excerpt from a longer short story called The Floating Fat Woman. We're going to start at the very beginning and then hop around a little bit. You hear this story about a fat woman who no longer bothers with gravity. The story goes that she floated up to her ceiling one afternoon while watching television and munching on cucumber slices. You hear the story at work because one of your coworkers emails you a link to an article dated just a few days after you'd left for your two-month-long mental health sabbatical, a forced vacation after your little breakdown in the office kitchen, an incident no one has mentioned directly in the 3 hours since you've been back. The comments section in the article includes a link to a Craigslist ad posted by the floating fat woman's daughter asking if anyone at all, might walk her mother for her. The way the fat woman floated was this. It was a Tuesday. The fat woman was alone when she suddenly drifted upward and hung there as if she were on the moon, bouncing slightly against the dusty walls. At the time, the fat woman was watching her favorite television show, the one about a vampire, a werewolf, and a ghost cohabitating in a Bristol flat. So at first, she didn't even notice. She was too wrapped up in the love story between the, spoilers, vampire and the ghost, and the werewolf's existential angst. The fat woman's daughter stopped by around dinner time to find her mother hanging from the ceiling lamp in the breakfast nook, watching the episode in which the vampire and the ghost admit their love for each other, and considering how the werewolf was especially lucky in all of this. His condition, as it were, was only a real issue once a month, while the vampire and the ghost had no relief from their bodily afflictions ever. The floating fat woman wiped tears from her cheeks as the ghost and the vampire accepted that their happiness was nearly impossible. You understand this, of course. You email the daughter and ask if maybe her mother would be interested in going into a museum. You say you have a season pass to the La Brea Tar Pits and you can take a buddy for free, which is a lie. You are not a member of that museum or any museum for that matter, nor do you know their policy on bringing buddies. But you feel it makes you sound cultured. A walk with this woman, this amazing floating woman, is the first thing you have wanted since you went away with a stitched-up hand, since you came back to a mildew-smelling apartment, since a long, long time, if you care to admit it. You are uneasy at your desk. The chair feels bumpy, trying to support you in all the wrong places. Your lamp gives off a sicklier yellow glow than you remember, which tints the photograph of you and your mother taped up on the edge of your computer monitor. The photo that was taken outside the Rite Aid of the two of you licking up triple scoop ice cream cones the day before her first chemo treatments. Your body wants to go to the kitchen, the elevator, anywhere but here. You hold it down and you make a type instead. You send the email and wait. This is what they did when the fat woman floated to the ceiling. Doctors and scientists were brought in, her blood was drawn, several reporters and talk show hosts interviewed her about her condition. There were many questions and many theories and many people speaking all at once. Merchandise with her image showed up on her porch, a beach ball, a plush toy, a yo-yo. During all the commotion, her body swaying against the ceiling as if treading invisible water, the floating fat woman tried her best to watch the episode in which the werewolf thinks he may have killed someone during his transformation, that he might be digesting human flesh at that very moment, and there was no coping mechanism for this kind of thing. When you meet the daughter, she looks haggard, droopy around the eyelids, hair falling over ears covered in piercings. She's thin and shallow-looking, empty and slightly wet, as if a freshwater fish might swim out of her eyes at any moment. Her daughter introduces you, and the floating fat woman nods, crunching down on slices of cucumbers, a bag of them hanging from her belt, leaking and causing a puddle of cucumber water beneath her. Her hair is wild, reaching at all angles to the ceiling as if she were Medusa, as if she were a mermaid. The daughter hands you a special leash that straps around your waist and says, "Just toss the other end to her mother and she'll strap herself to you." She manages a smile. "Have fun today, Ma. Don't float away on me." "Wouldn't dream of it," says the woman. The daughter leaves for work. The floating woman offers you a cucumber, and you refuse. You walk carefully to the door, the floating fat woman tethered to your waist. Outside, you half expect to be lifted away, but you feel only the slightest tug on your belt, as if the balloon were ready to be set free. This is how your day goes with the floating fat woman. There were a lot of scientific theories about how cookies or caffeine or hair gel or tap water could be the cause of the floating fat woman's situation, or how many eggs she'd eaten a week compared to the number of Russian novels she had read, and so on. The floating fat woman hasn't had those things in months, so the first thing you do is buy her a cookie, a hard-boiled egg, and a large dark roast brew at a coffee shop, where several children with their parents take pictures with the floating woman. She makes fart noises and pivots herself around in the air, pretending to lose control, bouncing against the umbrellas. The children laugh and clap. You laugh. Then you go to the hospital where she's still on payroll as a nurse, though officially on sabbatical, what with her condition. You hold your breath while you're here, trying not to think of the night with the stitches on your hand and the last night you spent on the fourth floor with your mother's unconscious body. The floating fat woman is greeted with smiles and attempts at hugs and a long conversation with one of the doctors about her daughter, who also works here. She says the daughter has just been a star, a real gem, never mentions you, though, and have you noticed how skinny she's gotten lately? As you leave the hospital, the tug on your belt gets just a tiny bit stronger. While on your way to the Liberia tar pits, the fat woman asks you to tell her a story about yourself. You say you're no good at that sort of thing, and she says, "Bullshit, just tell me a damn story." This is what you tell her. 2 months and a week ago, you took a jar of strawberry jelly out of the refrigerator at work and dropped it on the ground. You don't recall if this was on purpose or accidental. You scooped up the jelly, bright and sticky and shiny with glass, and closed your fist around it, letting the glass cut into your skin. You liked that you couldn't tell what was your blood and what was strawberry. You liked the pain of it. For once, your body felt like your own. You were sent to a wellness clinic in the mountains where you tried to meditate in the garden. The instructor would give breathy orders to imagine yourself in the ocean, imagine you're weightless, nothing can hold you down any longer. But you couldn't imagine it. So you tried to think of nothing instead. You tried to think of emptiness to fill yourself up with it. But there was always the ache in your hand, the smell of mothballs and warm printer cartridges and takeout chicken gone cold, the squeak of your white tennis shoes down hospital hallways, The shoes you scrubbed clean every night, the shoes now stained with strawberry jelly splatter. The La Brea tar pits smell and bubble and are otherwise disappointing. You and the floating woman stand by the edge. You stand, she hovers, and stare into the tar. Across the street is a billboard with a floating fat woman's photo clinging to her living room ceiling, big, bold letters that tell you to visit a website and buy the floating woman merchandise. As you watch, a team of workers in jumpsuits paints over the image and returns the billboard to a neutral white. The tug at your belt gets stronger. "I never saw a cent of that," says the floating fat woman. Thank you.
Amazing to see you all here. When I first read Wendy Lavinger's poems delivered by amazing matchmaker Amanda from the Emerging Voices program, I was puzzled. It seemed to me that this poet's voice had already emerged. Why then had we failed to listen to it? From our treasured conversations at a certain Culver City Argentine cafe, munching on poetry, alfajores de dulce de leche, don't salivate now, cheese and ham tostados, and more poetry, I learned a few things. Wendy had perfected her craft in multiple workshops. She could even count Philip Levine among her teachers. Why? What could I possibly contribute to her as a mentor? And why hadn't she read her poems outside a workshop environment before? Why hadn't she sent them out for publication? At our most recent meeting, Wendy told me about the poet who had inspired her to write, Theodore Rethke, someone we don't read in Latin America, but who, like our giant Rubén Darío, had developed his craft with tremendous discipline, perfecting the art of the imitation. The Poetry Society of America reports in its website that Rethke once wrote, quote, "Imitation, conscious imitation, is one of the great methods, perhaps the method of learning to write. The final triumph is what the language does, not what the poet can do or display." Wendy Lavinger found herself imitating a wide variety of styles and enjoying many workshops. She blossomed when writing under constraint. Yet, like little black dresses, constraints were making her work look interesting. The results pleased her teachers, but they were also concealing the flesh of her poetry with its fascinating shades, its silks, its gauzes. That little black dress was not letting her see what language was doing in her hands, that final triumph. Lavinger's poems are in conversation with dance and movement. Carefully crafted, they illuminate universal feelings, loss, nostalgia, love. Her images are poignant and anchored on daily, seemingly ordinary gestures. Her voice is trustworthy. "You added dark spices to my soup, re-ironed his shirt, and closed the door between us," tells the child to the proverbial stepmother in Once Upon a Time, "and we are left aching like that girl but thirsty for more." When this poetry has room in its generous heart to house a variety of voices and experiences, all strikingly genuine. Let's listen to her words and rejoice in the triumph of language. Please welcome Wendy and Lavinger.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much, Alicia. I can't tell you how much I love you, how much you mean to me. Un abrazo muy fuerte. Okay, so I teach English as a second language, and occasionally I've taught five-paragraph essays. So I'm going to read mine today. Love 101, an essay. The introduction. My soup went from hot to cold, untouched. My soda spilled on the floor. Corn got caught between his teeth, and we said the stupidest things. The body. I traced a map of the sky on his chest, tasted his scars. His legs were my blanket, his hands a warm desk. I counted his vertebrae more than once. I never knew such important bones. The conclusion. I can eat pancakes and read at the same time. Sorry. I can read pancakes and read at the same time. He can pass the butter without a tremble. And the accidental brushing of our fingers is a nice surprise. Sorry. The moment your heart began to crack. When was it that dark spot, the size of nothing, appeared right in the middle of that fist-sized organ? Like an engine that works until it doesn't, or a bicycle that moves until a child's dress gets caught in the chain. There is that infinitesimal moment when everything stops. Was it that exact second your hand refused the offer of mine? Did it happen in the slight tug on the cover from my side of the bed to yours? Or in that small space between good and bye as you left for work? Or was it in that flash when the last sun of summer burned green at the horizon and you said, let's turn back? Disquiet. This room is different today, as if a thief has entered and inhaled all of its harmony in one breath, inhaled the sound of morning steps, metal of spoons on bowls, water on skin, drawn into his lungs the slight vibration of bedside lamps, the locking of evening doors. He has left nothing, not voices in the dark, nor the quiet purring of cats. Thank you. This next poem was written after the tragedy in Orlando, and it's for the victims. The idea of dance is moving your body as if it were your last day, touching stars on the ceiling, spinning as if you are in control of gravity, of the tides, and taking in your arms friends and strangers. It is not moving your body on your last day, never dreaming of touching stars again, losing control of your spin, falling down in the tide of your own blood and being taken in the arms of friends and strangers. Okay. My body in haiku. Stolen. Give me back my eyes without these laugh lines. Not funny at all. My lips have grown thin. I have less and less to say. A kiss might move them. hair the size of earth, worked into knots of white curls. Thank God for red dye. Torso, once thin, cold, has grown breasts that burn at night. My dreams are on fire. My hands have held bees, been drowned in scalding water, and still they want more. One day I will leave, take only my brilliant light, bury this body. Hey, thank you. So this is the last poem, and this is a dream that I have. I have it almost every day, this poem. I have this dream. But I want to thank Michelle and Libby and Amanda for helping me realize another dream. I thank you so much. And Amanda, thank you for being our mom and holding our hands. And thank you, my fellow sisters. I love you. I have been longing for rivers, to sit at the edge in sleeveless heat, to be barefoot and drenched in the day, to lie under willows heavy in summer branches, reach down through lilies and frog dreams. I have been longing for wide rivers where I'll swim past trout and carp, burrow down into the muddy floor, glad in this wet life. Thank you. Thank you.
Working with another writer is always rewarding, but it was especially exciting and fulfilling to read the work of an up-and-coming Emerging Voices writer that resonated so strongly with me, I had to check my votives and reasons as to why. Not so oddly, what I realized was her work dealt with many of the same issues and ideas that I explore in my writing. As an outcast punk rocker slash former junkie bank robber trying to find his place in this convoluted maze of modern-day society, I've chronicled some of the darker aspects of humanity. So when another writer taps into those mutual imperfections of the human condition, well, that writer is playing my song. My attention is riveted to their words, embracing their prose, and with this writer, I discovered just that. Here was the same longing for identity, a sense of displacement, and life is a constant struggle with disappointments pierced with moments of humor and that gut-wrenching beauty that only diving deep into the emotional darkness can provide. More than once, I found myself rereading a passage and seeing the parallels and similarities, as if I was staring into a mirror that her words were creating. Deep down, I figured we'd be so much alike that it would explain it all. And then when we actually met, I was surprised to find that I wasn't staring into the well into his 50s, spiky-haired, self-depreciating Irishman, but at a 31-year-old second-generation Asian-American woman. Her life experience couldn't have been more different than mine, yet that is what the cross-cultural platform of literature, especially the reality of nonfiction memoir, does. It allows our life stories to be heard, and in doing so, makes us all one. Writers that are able to glean their emotions and experiences and put them into words that thrust themselves into our psyche are a gift. And Jen Hong is that gift. There are voices that need to be heard. Yet because of the status quo, that aforementioned modern-day society, some do not always get to be heard, as if they didn't exist. But the reality is that person does exist. She has a story. It is a story of struggle and strength and beauty. Jen Hong is one such person. She tells us her story, evokes our emotions, and now we hear her. In this traditional literary world, overly unbalanced in regards to gender and race, it is well past time to consider another scenario. Lucky for us, that is the purpose of the Emerging Voices Fellowship, and now because of that, we all can look forward to the intensity and talent that is Jen Hong.
Everybody, I can't believe I'm actually here. Ditto on all the thank yous. Thank you to Penn. Thank you to all of my friends who's here. And thank you to Patrick O'Neill, who have gone above and beyond reading my, you know, terrible, grammatically incorrect work and suffering through it. So if this sucks, it's his fault. My dad is blind, my mom is deaf, and 6 weeks ago, our dog of 10 years developed cancer in her jaw. I was so blindsided by the news at the vet's office that I had to go sit alone in the parking lot to cry. I cried for the adopted dog, I cried for having so many sick people depend on me, and I cried for having to take half a day off of work for this. Nobody is healthy. It used to be that I wanted a partner with all sorts of requirements. Tall, handsome, smart, funny. He must be romantic but practical, comedic but serious, rugged but sensitive, this but that. Nowadays, though, you just gotta be able to see, smell, hear, and not be dying. Do you love me? Okay, but really, do you also have insurance? I adopted my dog 10 years ago. Her name is Roxy, but my parents approximate the sound and call her Lucky. You know, the way I see it, there are two kinds of people in this world. Those that will eat their pets if need be, and those that won't. My mom told me that she grew up way poorer than I did. During the 1960s and 70s in China, millions of people starved to death. She considered herself lucky to have survived. She sold her hair, sold her clothes, even sold the family's wood-barrel toilet for food money. She told me that she once had a large black dog that used to follow her to school each day. She named him Dog. Dog and Mom had a great relationship. She'd walk, he'd follow. She'd talk, he'd listen. She was hungry, and Dog would go steal chickens from the open-air markets. By the time he made it back to her, the chicken would be covered in dirt and spit. And then Dog disappeared. It was days before her two younger brothers and sisters told her what had happened. They clubbed it while she was at school, killed it, and ate it. She told me that she cried for days. Often at dinner, I would say to my mom, "Stop feeding Roxy table scraps. Her belly is already touching the ground. She is way too fat." "Don't yell in front of your sister," my mom would say. "She can understand you. She's a dog." "No, she's not a dog. She is our baby." As soon as my mom got home from work each day, and even with jaw cancer, Roxy slash Lucky would run up to the door and sit up on her meaty little fat hind legs and wag her tail. My mom would then pick her up and rock her back and forth like the grandchild I never gave her. How could she even compete with that? I'm so used to people coming and going from my life. It happened often when I was a kid. We lived in a motel half the time when my dad worked his rotating 24-hour shifts. One day at home in South LA, one day at the motel on 3rd and Alexandria. All sorts of people appeared and disappeared. Young couples hiding from their parents, lovers on an unfortunately tight budget, second-tier mistresses, dealers, buyers, and sellers of all kinds. Every once in a while, though, we had out-of-towners who ended up there just because they didn't know any better. Whatever the reason, no one actually wanted to be there. The Alexandra Motel was not a destination. It was a stop on the way to something better. But I remember I met a girl once there named Annie. I was 8 or 9 that summer, not long after the LA riots, and she was about the same age. We became friends because we both stood as tall as the motel service counter. We also used inhalers. Mine had a yellow cap, and hers was a pretty purple with an elephant sticker on top. The first time I met Annie, I was perched on top of my dad's desk inside the motel office, and she was standing on the other side of the bulletproofed windowed counter. She and her mom drove up in a long blue boxy Cadillac with crumpled paper bags piled so high that it covered the whole backseat window. Annie held her mom's pant leg and peeked her head up at me and smiled. That was a great thing about being a kid. It didn't really take much to let her guards down. For the first few days, Annie and her mom hardly came out of their room. I only saw them when her mom would get something from the car or when they passed by the office on their way to get fast food from the China Boy Express restaurant around the corner. Sometimes I would catch a glimpse of Annie from her office window trying to catch a glimpse of me from her room across the lot. Then we started a game of who could duck faster. A few weeks went by, and eventually she came out of her room and asked if I wanted to play. Annie and her mom had driven out to LA from someplace far away. Someplace that started with the letter A. Could have been Arkansas or Arizona or maybe Anaheim. My dad told me that somebody bad was looking for the two of them, which is why they were staying here for a while. Annie, where are you? Her mom yelled from inside the room window. She kept their curtains shut most of the time. We ran together on the asphalt parking lot and looked for lizards in the ivy wall in the back. We imagined that the motel was our big mansion, and we ran from room to room, hiding from and searching for each other. I showed her my skates. She showed me her mom's knife collection. My dad liked them because they always paid the rent on time each week and in cash. I didn't speak much English back then, so she taught me new words like castle and shoes. But then one day, Annie left. I showed up during my dad's 11 a.m. shift change with my skates and saw that their door was open. The cleaning cart was parked in front. No goodbyes, just a void. My mom said to me, "We need you to walk Lucky into the veterinarian's office the day we have to put her down. It's just too painful for your dad and me to say goodbye. We love her too much." My dad said, "Please hold her when they euthanize her. I need you to be strong for us." Then he rolled up a $20 bill and stuffed it in my hand like this would make things easier. I got Roxy / Lucky from an animal shelter about 10 years ago by sheer dumb luck. I was looking for a dog and she was available that day. Animal control had found her in a dumpster with a rope around her neck. She was not the kind of dog that I thought I would fall in love with. She ate chicken bones off the streets, barked at buses, and she farted all the time. But she could also sit up like a kangaroo. Each time I visited her, she wagged her tail and kissed my face and made me feel like she had been waiting for me her whole life. Sometimes I think about what I would have said to Annie if I had the chance to say goodbye to her. "Don't forget to call me. I got you a soda for the road." Or maybe I would say, "Thanks. It was really brief, but you've opened my heart. And damn it, it hurts." Thank you.
Hello. My first job at Penn Center USA, immediately following my fellowship year, was to pair mentors with fellows. It was quite the responsibility. It was an endeavor I entered into most earnestly. I researched, I had a whiteboard, I emailed, I stalked writers online, sometimes in person. I looked deeply into what those new fellows wanted and tried to forecast into what they didn't know they needed yet. I looked for the right alchemy. I had no idea I would have the honor of pairing mentors with Emerging Voices fellows years to come as the program manager. I always describe mentorship as the heart of the fellowship, but it's a multifaceted heart, a heart that lifts the writer's head when it's down in the muck and says, "Look up," a heart that points to a bright spot on a defeated page and that reminds you that rejections make for good kindling. It says you're not nuts, and that hope can be found in the next sentence you write, and if not that one, then the next one. It's a heart that knows when to push, even when the writer says, "I don't know, I'm not sure if I can," but then they do. I'll leave you with this quote from George Saunders. Just think of mentor when I say teacher. Why do we love our writing teachers so much? Why, years later, do we think of them with such gratitude? I think it's because they come along when we need them most, when we are young and vulnerable and are tentatively approaching this craft, which we are beginning to love. They have so much power. They can mock us, disregard us, use us to prop themselves up. But our teachers, if they are good, instead do something almost holy, which we never forget. They take us seriously. They accept us as new members of the Guild. I want to honor all the mentors tonight, not just on the stage or in this auditorium, but every writer who has served the Emerging Voices Fellowship and all the heart they gave to it. Thank you to Aloud for hosting us, and I hope all the Emerging Voices alum, friends, and family will stay to join us in the reception and to celebrate 20 years of mentorship, 20 years of fellows, 20 years of literary community, and to congratulate the 2016 Emerging Voices Fellows. Let's give them another round of applause.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.